Welcome to this week's Casterbris Podcast with a K, available on Casterbris, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
My name is Christian Corley, editor of Casterbris.com, and this is James McLean.
Someone.
I'm sorry?
That's what I am. I'm someone.
You're a someone.
The someone.
Well, you're nobody until someone loves you. So clearly someone loves you.
Oh, that's a depressing thought, isn't it? I think the someone, so it's actually quite a good name for a show, that. It's sort of like the Doctor, the someone. It's got a ring to it. I could pitch something on that, I think.
You think?
No. Okay. How are you today?
I'm chipper, really, I think. Is the word.
Had a chipper.
Had Pucker. A good morning. Pucker. Yeah, had a good morning, which always helps when you get to the afternoon. And always helps on a week that begins with a Monday, as these invariably do. Mm-hmm. What about yourself?
Invariably. Not so bad. It's been a quiet day for me so far. I overslept, which is bad.
Oh, right. Okay.
No idea why, but
happens
I did.
Rarely in this.
That's what happens when you have children.
Indeed. Yes, I know.
I kind of like going into these podcasts feeling I've got something intuitively interesting or sparkling to say, but today I have zero. I feel absolutely dully normal. But thankfully, there's quite a few good topics to actually take away from my dully somewhat normalness.
Yes, there is indeed. Well, shall we we'll just do a quick rundown of what we're going to talk about in this week's podcast. And thank you for everyone who tuned into and downloaded last week's podcast. We did very well last time. We did about 4,000 listens so far, so that's good news. So we're going to talk about Peter Capaldi, various attire. Maybe talk about Marco Polo for a little while. We've got a new Doctor Who recurring cast member has been announced today as we record the podcast.
Yeah.
And we'll also... give a brief mention to Matt Smith, who's done something rather wonderful in the last week or so. So to crack on, we'll do it in order, James, as in the email. Time Lord sweatshirts. There's a couple of photos doing the rounds. There's actually more than the two that we're aware of, because I've been made aware of, or that we were initially aware of, because I've been made aware of several more. A Peter Capaldi wearing a spotty sweater.
Yeah.
A kind of a flecked sweater, isn't it? It's a black sweatshirt with sort of whitey, silvery, grey kind of flecks on it. Has a kind of a punk vibe to it, which is interesting given Capaldi's past. Now we've been led to believe that this is a variation on his outfit. Some people would rather believe that it is just a jumper.
Well where's the source that says that it is a variant on the outfit?
I'm not allowed to divulge that.
Oh right, but you like, okay, let me put this in another way which doesn't put you into a problem or make you look so attention-seeking that you're such a big Doctor Who fan that you know these things.
Okay.
There is a sort of valid source suggesting this is part of his costume. Because I must admit, when I saw the pictures, it looked to me like Capaldi putting a jumper on between takes and keeping the jacket on so it doesn't get damaged and lost.
But a shirt that big, you would notice it under the jumper, wouldn't you?
I suppose. But I must admit, I've only seen the one photograph, and that was from the Twitter feed.
There's a second that's from a Tumblr, which is from the same location. It's just a slightly different angle with a different person.
I don't know. I mean, to me, I see your point. But to me, it still looks a bit like someone who's not in costume. Or we might perhaps even put the jacket on to make a photo shot look better. I don't know. What's the second one? Is the second one actually like the first one where he's actually having a photo taken with someone? Or is it him just wandering around with the jumper and the... Is it actually on the link? He says, suddenly realising. Because I'm a bit of a detective, this. When someone sends me a link, sometimes it has info in it that I can actually use.
Yeah. There is a link in the original article. There's a link to the Tumblr, I think, and the Twitter one.
Yeah, the Twitter one is there.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, I see the Tumblr link. Let's have a quick look at this. Yeah, well, you see, it's another... It's a tough one, isn't it? I mean...
It is tough. I'll give you that. It's tough.
I mean, it's less tough if, as you say, you've got some inside source which suggests it is relevant. It is very odd if it is, because it goes against very much the... not the feel of the costumers we've seen the costumers we've seen promoted has a very specific aesthetic sense, a style, a tone, you may say, which is perhaps to sort of in some way indicative of the character. This to me looks like Peter Capaldi out of outfit wearing the coat for some reason. But then, as I say, you have your secret worm mold.
Well, indeed. I mean, like we've been strongly advised that this is a variation. So I mean, we'll just have to wait and see, won't we?
It's a very interesting variation. It is, because it gives a totally different tone to the character than the first one does. I mean, if you think of all the if we think of the Doctor's, the few changes in the Doctor's wear that we've had over the history, they normally always sit on the same theme. I can't think of one actually that has any massive change apart from sort of slight a color or a slight tone change. I mean, aside from Matt Smith switching his outfit for his last year, really they've all stayed very much the same, haven't they?
Yeah.
So this would be a very different one if because that just gives it a total different feel to him if it's the case, which is interesting. So not knocking it, I'd be pro it, to be honest, just because I think it's doing something a little different.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens, won't we? I like the look of it. I think it's interesting. But obviously, as I say, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think that's a good move to do. We'll just see what happens. Rather than avoiding to find out what goes on, we will see what happens.
Yeah. Okay. Marco Polo. We discussed Marco Polo a few weeks ago.
And we did.
And, you know, there is this continuing Omni-rumour thing, dear Casterb writes. Which basically is this ongoing, all-encompassing rumour that all these missing episodes, or all these episodes that were once thought to be missing, have been found, or are in the process of being found, or might not be missing, or live in the hands of collectors, etc., etc., etc. Now, we wouldn't like to get you over-enthused by the prospect of a 50-year-old serial suddenly being rediscovered. But as I say, we have already discussed this, so this shouldn't be anything that's particularly new to you, I don't think.
No.
Now, so the rumour has continued. At the Gallifrey 1 event last weekend, it's kind of mid-February by the time you're listening to this, there was reports of the Restoration Team founding member Steve Roberts was on the panel. And he indicated that he didn't. But I'll say what we've put in our news item. He quoted a letter from Philip Morris, who is the guy who's credited as discovering the enemy of the world and the web of fear. The letter said that the remainder of a large haul of discovered film prints of vintage television shows had been discovered in Nigeria, and they were still being sorted through. However, we were told to expect the unexpected, and Roberts had reason to believe that the most likely find is all or some of Marco Polo, the only missing serial from season one. Now, that's encouraging. It's more encouraging than what we've already heard, and that was already encouraging, some of which we can't repeat here. What do you think?
I was talking to a journalist friend of mine the other day, and he's normally fairly clued up on all the stuff from the BBC, and he says he's never heard anything about any of these missing episodes, which I don't for a minute suggest that means that they're not true. But what he asked, which is a very, very good question, is why is there so much secrecy over this? I mean, I'm not talking about Marco Polo specifically, because, I mean, if they had just got, say, Marco Polo as well as the two they've just released, you could say, fine, fair enough. You can understand why there's no need to bring that out into the open. But the suggested amount that they may or may not have, including, as we talked about last week with Gareth, the slight drop on the comment on Power of the Daleks, and how it's a shame that Christopher Barry will never see it, sort of suggests that there's a lot of potential historical archives have been found. Why keep it so quiet? I mean, we've talked about this a bit before as well. We've sort of said, well, maybe it's to do with trying to keep the market from becoming too greedy when trying to negotiate deals with these sort of materials. But that in itself still seems a bit odd. I it seems just really weird, this sort of silence over this.
I mean, it's secrecy, as you say, it's silent. Perhaps it's actual genuine time travel that's found these episodes. Top secret stuff has been going on.
It seems more top secret than anything else that the BBC's I've ever seen the BBC do. I mean, everything leaks so easily. Even, you know, castings and the like. Well, to be fair, actually, they kept Capaldi back for a good time before the bookies started to realise.
Yeah.
So in fairness, that they do it. But it just seems a very odd thing, especially if there is as much as we think there might be. I mean, we've talked about Mockupied before, as you say in the article. We talked about it in November, where the Daily Mirror sort of broke the point that Marco Polo may have been found. And strangely enough, there seemed to be very little reaction to that across the fandom. I thought that was quite a big assertion for a newspaper to come out and to point to a very specific episode, story, should I say.
Yeah.
I'm not saying Doctor Who's have been found, but Marco Polo. And yet, Who fandom didn't seem to ignite over that. Seemed to go,
Yeah, well, I'm going to put this as delicately as possible. We have heard that someone related to that production has been told that they've been found. So,
well, I don't doubt it. I mean, as we've said 1,000 times now this last year, where there's smoke, there's fire. And there's smoke in so many different directions on this Omni rumour that there's no doubt, to my mind, that there is truth here.
It's an inferno.
It's an inferno. And I think it's very... I think, as I've said before, when we spoke about which ones we'd like to see come back, Marco Polo has always been the one out of all of them that I've wanted to see return. So, yeah, I'm particularly excited about that. And if we got Power of the Daleks as well, as intimated last week, I think that would be one of my... Well, I think it would be most people's top Troughton one to see, I think, wouldn't you say?
Power of the Daleks?
Power of the Daleks?
Yeah, I should think so, yeah.
That'd be pretty awesome. So, yeah, no, I think it's very encouraging.
Just while we're on the topic of missing episodes, there is something else which I would like to see, and that's Dalek's Master Plan. And the final tranche of copies will soon be on sale. On Casterbus.
Oh, very good, very good. Bravo.
With a slightly different package. Right, we're going to move on to some new series stuff today. There's been lots of kind of rumours going on. We'll start with the thing that has been confirmed, and there is a new recurring character in Doctor Who, Series 8. Actor called Samuel Anderson, who's he's another former history boy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also... been in Gavin and Stacey and Emmerdale. Sure, he probably won't be telling the world about that when he's 60. The latter one there. And he's been cast as Danny Pink, another teacher at Coal Hill School. What do you think of this return to Coal Hill School?
I think it's quite a nice idea, isn't it? It's. Do you have an issue with it?
I don't know if I've got any. I find it a little bit twee. To be honest,
do you feel it's sort of is it heading? I've never seen people actually mention this, but you know, back in the 80s, they'd have called this JNT territory JNTT.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's it is Fanwenak, isn't it? In some ways,
it is a bit. I mean, yeah, I understand what you mean. I mean, to me, I don't think it bothers me because they set up for the 50th. That she was working at Coal Hill School and we all swallowed that because it was the 50th anniversary and took it on board. So in a sense, there is sort of a logic that if you're going to have another teacher, have it at that school rather than have a move to a different school now because we've gone past the 50th. So in a sense, in that sort of narrative extension, I think fine, it's fair. But I know what you mean. It is a bit close to the bone. And I'll be interested to see how that school looks. It'll be like the third version of that school we'll have seen, won't it?
Yeah, yeah.
They go to Totters Lane. We'll have about the fifth version of Totters Lane, probably. I can't count how many they've had. Yeah, but I think it's good. I mean, we all said that this was going to happen, that if they were going to go for an older doctor, they would do as they did with Hartnell and as they had planned to do with Baker. They'd bring in a younger character, probably reoccurring, who would help.
It's a bit handy.
Handy and a bit handsome. To offset the sort of older male, and especially since we have, as we've said before, such a doctors being a lot younger of late, or being more vibrant and youthful, people tuning into Doctor Who who are new fans will be looking for a certain youthful handsomeness. I think so. I think it's a fair play.
Okay. The actor says, I was so excited to join Doctor Who, I wanted to jump and click my heels. But I was scared I might not come down before filming started. Don't think there's much chance of that happening. It's a quintessential part of British culture, and I can't believe I'm part of it. It's an honour to be able to work alongside Peter Capaldi and Jenna Coleman, and I can't wait to show people how my character becomes involved with such a fantastic duo.
Well,
it's all very nice.
It's kind of nice that, you know, the majority, I mean, like with Capaldi, that he's so so thrilled to be part of it. It's nice that a lot of the actors who have been involved in Doc 2 since its return have had such a love of it, like Tennant, for instance, is a good example.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, that, yeah.
It's nice that they can get involved in something that they truly respect. Yeah, I think it's kind of good, and I think it's important as well, because as I think I might have said in previous ones, there is a certain sexism in the viewers and in the show to a degree, so far as this thing that you can have an older Doctor who perhaps isn't quite as sexy, and the young fangirls can lump it, which a lot of fans say with relish. But you can't have an old female companion. It's always got to be a 20-something female. And not to have that would be considered ridiculous and heinous. You've got to have the young girl. But you can't... You don't have that same sort of perspective on the male side. You can have the old man. Hmm. So in a sense, I think it's kind of... I think that shows a little bit of balance in the show, just to understand and appreciate the fact that as a lot of dads watch Doctor Who for Jenna Louise Coleman, a lot of girls and women will watch Doctor Who for the young, vibrant hero. So, and he's, you know, he's a good looking guy, this guy. I think it's a good move. He looks interesting. I mean, I'm not very familiar with his work, to be honest, but yeah, I think it's probably a good cast, that.
Okay. There's a few other things been going on in Doctor Who as well, rumor wise. There's a rumor that we've reported on over the weekend that Peter Capaldi's only staying for one season. This isn't the first time this has popped up. However, more recently, the Mirror has reported it in their, I think it was their Sunday edition. Would you like to see him stay longer than a year?
Well,
do you think he's going to go?
As far as I understand, because I've been talking about this to other people, there's this misconception in Doctor Who fandom that Doctor Who contracts go over a year. They don't.
It,
they sit for a year with an optional... with the prospective option of going on longer.
And that's mutual, isn't it?
Yes. And as far as I understand, Capaldi's had no different contract to that. So he's got the year's contract with the option of leaving or continuing on with a prospect, I think, from what I was told, two to three years, I think. Mm. So this is no different to any other situation. I think this is just people leaping onto a media news bandwagon and misreading a truth as something that it isn't, either for a story or because they want to. Mm. At the same time, there would be a logical argument in doing the same thing as Eccleston, but we've also got to remember that we now know from history that Eccleston didn't intend to just go in for a year. It was the same thing, a year's contract, option to do more. He decided not to option to do more. So in a sense, it could parallel what happened with Davis is in the way of springboarding a new fresh way to do Doctor Who, a year with a new Doctor, then go on with another one. Mm-hmm. But I get the impression, I suspect that he will go on for more than a year because one, he seems to love the show. And two, I think the character of the Doctor for an actor is one that if they actually enjoy the character anyway, is one that they'd like to explore in more than 13 episodes.
Yeah.
So I think he'll go on for more than a year. I don't think there's any truth to the thing that he's just down for a year.
And there's a similar rumor going around about Clara as well, about Jenna Coleman.
I could see her moving on.
Right.
Definitely. I could see her.
Well, that would be kind of one and a half series, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Although her presence for two series, I suppose.
Her profile's rising. She's a good actress. I don't get the impression that she's got any massive investment in Doctor Who as, say, you know, Capaldi had or Tennant has. Really. but at the same time, I got this slight impression, and I could be wrong, that like a lot of actors, when there's a changeover, they don't tend to feel as comfortable after the changeover or some go before the changeover because they don't feel like it's going to be the same thing again when the actor changes. And I got kind of a feeling from a couple of things she said last year, almost, that the loss of Smith was actually going to be quite a hard thing for her. And I don't know, I was saying that's just backseat observations. I've no proof either way on that. So I kind of expected her to go after this season, actually, the series, on that sort of basis. But again, it's just conjecture. It'd be fine if she goes. She's done a good job. I don't think her character really made what they really made what they could have out of it.
Do you think she would have worked better as the governess?
Yeah, I think she'd work better as the governess. And I think, and this is no disrespect to her, I think her character in the end turned out to be no different really to Amy Pond. There was just really nothing there beyond what the actress brings to it. But she brings a lot to it because she's a good, strong actress and she's done well with the role. But I think the faffing around with the characters left the character fairly... You could put her, you could put Bonnie Langford, you could put Elizabeth Sladen into that role. It is a role to support the Doctor. It doesn't feel like there's any real depth or motivation to that character. There is really no motivation to that character at all. She just wanders with the Doctor. She's got no aim, she's got no focus, she's got no dreams. She just floats. So I could see the actress maybe thinking, well, maybe I could do something that she's got a little more dramatic investment
in. And she's got a career at the same time.
Well, that could actually help the character.
Or it could hinder it, as you say, because she just hangs around with the Doctor occasionally.
Well, yeah, I don't think this is a good mode. I mean, Moffat's...
Well, that's been going on for a while, hasn't it?
Amy.
Well, since, really, I suppose, when he dropped them off at the end of Series 6.
Yeah.
Where he's had the companion coming in and out with the TARDIS. I think it's an interesting idea, but eventually it stops working, doesn't it? It's not a default for Doctor Who. It shouldn't be a default for Doctor Who. There should be very few defaults in Doctor Who, but one of them should be that the Doctor's always got a companion with him at all times, not someone who goes home occasionally.
Yeah, no, I think so. Well, I mean, as we've said before, and I've said this since 2005, I can understand why Davis wanted to root the character on Earth for a while to allow the kids to actually to feel the link of family, character, and Rose's family actually helped define Rose a lot. I mean, the way her mum was, her mum was a fairly flirty, rootless character, living in quite a horrible estate. It helped define who Rose was, so that was very intelligent. And to a certain degree, Martha's family informed who she was, and so did Donna's. When you get to Moffat's era, there are no real families. It's pretty much just the single characters. So the rooting them on Earth doesn't help benefit their character.
The companions are Enid Blyton characters, aren't they, in Stephen Moffat? Because they don't have families who are there all the time. They can just go off and do what they want. They can go around investigating and things without any worry or concern that they're going to come to any danger.
And as we've said before, the problem with that is that it makes it very easy to write because they have no investment. It means all they can have to do is invest in the plot of the story.
Yeah.
So, they don't, if it had been the governess from Victoria Land, you'd have had to sort of focused on how she would perceive things from her Victorian perspective.
Exactly.
You don't have to worry about that if it's a contemporary companion. No. So it does seem a very lazy and it damages the characters quite dramatically. So yeah, I mean, maybe the teaching will give her some sort of route, but ultimately I think they'd be very wise in, and I don't think they're going to do this, uprooting her and this other companion and give them an agenda. It just strikes me that this is, I mean, we've said this again 1,000 times, so I'm sorry if you're one of the few thousand listeners who've heard me say this over and over again, but they need to give the companion some sort of an agenda. The companions that just float with no agenda in the show have never worked very well. You take Bonnie Langford's Mel. She had no real beginning. They said, she was a computer girl from Peace Cottage. What does that mean? It doesn't give you anything. So the actress, the character just floats as a cipher. Characters which work, things like Tegan, while I found her a bit abrasive, her having to follow the Doctor trying to get home, or Ian and Barbara trying to get home, it gives them some sort of grounding. You take Jamie, he doesn't have a focus on where he wants to go, but from where he comes from, gives the character something to play with because he's out of sorts with the viewer to a degree.
Yeah,
he's an exotic, you could call it, an exotic companion. as are companions from the future. They become exotic, so they don't necessarily need a goal because they're exotic themselves. Zoe, again, is an example of that. You've got, you know, it's very few companions, I think, that sit well unless the actor's very good or very charming. Liz Sladen's an example of
that.
She managed it very, very well. But Ian Marta worked because he felt out of place. And Rory worked for that as well, because Rory was never comfortable in the role of the companion. So that sort of, he didn't have a goal per se, apart from looking after Amy, but it helped. This is what I mean. So they need to have something about either their past or their future to help define them. And that to me is always a strength in the companion.
Okay.
Yeah, well.
Okay. I couldn't agree more with that. Right, well, listener, we're going to move on to our recommendations shortly, but we thought we'd probably better let you know about this rather wonderful thing that Matt Smith did recently. He was in the United States, but he took the time to send a video message to a little lad who's not feeling... Which is a really nice thing to do. A little lad called Jack Robinson... he's been diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumour. And so Matt Smith sent him a video message to say that he's going to come and see him later on. That was really, really nice. There's absolutely no reason for him to go out of his way to do that.
No. No, I've got nothing really cynical to say about this. especially because I'd feel a total dick if I did.
Well, I think we can. This is a Tom Baker comparison moment, isn't it? I think.
Yeah.
Because we know that Tom Baker used to visit children in hospital during his time in Doctor Who, and feel quite useless by all accounts, but he still managed to put a smile on the little ones' faces. And this seems to have had a. This is along the same sort of lines. It's really sweet.
Do you Okay, let's try and find a story point for this, apart from obviously the feel good factor, which is it is a very nice. If you've not seen the video, please do see it because it really is quite touching. Two things. Do you think he should go and see him as the Doctor rather than as Matt Smith? Now he says it's Matt Smith here. But from the kid's point of view, would it be better? And I'm not saying he would be bad if he didn't, but I'm just saying, would you think that would be the preferred way to go and visit him as a Doctor or as Matt Smith?
I don't know.
I mean, it's just, you know, as a kid, I'm just trying to think what would be...
Because, Tom Baker used to turn up in costume, didn't he, in character, when he visited children.
Well, that's it, exactly. Should he do that, or should he be true to himself as Matt Smith, the person who is... obviously genuinely touched or upset about what this child's going through and would like to actually appear as
him anymore.
Well, exactly. Well, I think to be fair, in some degrees, he'll always be the Doctor, especially for kids. But in a sense, you could argue there's a certain truth from Matt's point of view is that it is Matt Smith who is making this gesture, not the Doctor. Hmm. You know, Matt wants to connect with this kid. I don't know. It's an interesting.
Well, what do you think?
I think, for the kid, I would probably go as the Doctor, although I would understand as Matt Smith why I would want to go as Matt Smith, because, you know, it is Matt who is obviously being touched by this.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's making that sort of gesture. It's a fascinating thing, as you say. I mean, someone mentioned this to me the other day and asked, did I think that Matt Smith has made a mistake going early? I'll rephrase that. Does Matt Smith think, or will he feel, that he's made a mistake leaving when he did? And I have a feeling he might do.
Yeah.
Because there is a certain pressure and obligation to the Doctor, which I think probably does age you. I think it has aged him.
Well, I think there anything ages anyone because time progresses, doesn't it?
Well, it does to a degree, but I think very, very high pressure, very involved roles will inevitably wear you out sooner than it's the reason why royalty tends to live longer than poor people, because poor people generally in the end work a lot harder than people who are in high
shapeshifting lizards.
Yes, and that's not trying to be detrimental against the royals, but it's just a fact of
all lizards,
you know, at the bottom it's very hard, it's very manual, it's very tough, and people don't live as long and they don't eat as well, whatever. But
it's
point
a
being,
man's
it does...
life at the bottom.
It is, anyway. But yeah, the point being is that he seems to be a genuinely nice guy, and I sometimes feel that will he regret leaving it so early when being that guy gives him so much ability to affect people in ways that no other role will? I think that's what I feel. Mm. I think maybe he'll regret that in a way, losing that. And I don't know whether the choice was his. I mean, I know agents put a hell of a lot of pressure on actors to move on at the right time for their careers and everything, and for the agents' monies, and managers' monies, and agents' monies. What do you think?
I think I agree, to be honest with you. I think he already has kind of had regrets about leaving. So I think he's probably past that point now. I mean, I hope he doesn't dwell on it, because that's not going to do him any good.
No, it's just I was wondering whether maybe it will come back to haunt him in a sense, not in a massive way. I mean, we make our choices and we move on.
Indeed, we do. Indeed.
I think it's a good question. Ah, yeah, it's just a really nice little video. And it's a nice example of when people do have the ability to make people's lives better through circumstance. And Doctor Who has given him such a platform. I imagine Capaldi will be very similar. I have a story actually about Capaldi. I was talking to one of my relatives who's an actress, does a lot, and she says when she was very young, she went to a play which had Peter Woodward. Those who watched Babylon 5 and Crusade might remember Peter Woodward, who played Galen, the mythical technomage, and he has a very famous father. And she went to see him. And she was taken backstage to see him. And she'd taken to his room, opened the door, and she went in there. And her face dropped when she saw Peter Capaldi. And they'd taken her to the wrong room. And he looked at her, and she looked at him, and he said, you were looking for Peter Woodward, weren't you? She said, yeah. And he smiled. And she said he was so sweet. And later on, she got to work with Peter Woodward anyway in the theatre. And she had interesting stories to tell about him. But the point being, she said he seemed really nice, Capaldi, when she met him. And that was obviously years and years ago when he was younger. So I think he's probably a genuinely nice guy who will probably take up this mantle of the Doctor well and do the same sort of things as Smith here is doing and as Baker, as you say, did when he was in the role.
Cool. Okay. I like that story.
Yeah, so did I.
Okay, it is recommendations time. This is going to possibly maybe painful listening to anyone who likes centaurs. do you want to go first or shall I?
I'll go first because I think yours is more amusing.
Okay then.
I've actually done twofold. I finished The Mind of Evil, which I started last week, and I thought it was brilliant, as I thought it would be. I didn't remember it as well as I thought I did. There was very little I could complain about it. Features were quite good. They were a little short, given that, you know, the second disc was just features and there was really only two documentaries on there, as I recall. Mm-hmm. But
they are good ones.
It's a beautiful story because it does what Pertwee's era can do really well, and that's that beautiful mesh of outside location and good interiors. Mm-hmm. So you get the good interiors which work for the story, and section B of prison is brilliantly done, and then you have some lovely outside shots which are just great because they just give you the feeling of the 70s, or is it the 80s? I can never remember. And that's kind of cool from a historical point of view, and it's just a brilliant story, and everyone plays the parts so very, very well. So yeah, that was very good. I'd obviously recommend Mind of Evil if you've never seen it. It's probably one of the most epic stories. If I was going to pick a story from each era, Mind of Evil would definitely be my one for John Pertwee, because it just imbues everything good. I mean, his first season's very good, but then you've got Delgado in that. Secondly, I watched Seas of Doom yesterday, and I watched it all in one go, which is very unlike me. And then I watched half of the commentary as well. So again, it's a story. I'd almost say it's a story that I would say is perfect for Tom Baker, but it does feel like it's an episode too long for me. Mm-hmm. There's a little too bit much running around Chase's mansion than it needs.
Chase's mansion.
I mean, yes. Chase's mansion. The mansion's good. There's a lot of creepiness in the mansion, and Chase is brilliant. But it just feels like it could just have been truncated a bit more. I think the monsters the crinoids, the kilo crinoids growing too big too soon.
Right.
So, and when it's that size, I think it carries a lot less threat than when it's a single monster roaming around, like in the Arctic.
Man-shaped.
Yes, I think that. At the same time, I think it is one of the only examples I can think of old Doctor Who, which I think is truly quite horrific from a horror point of view, bar maybe Resurrection of the Daleks, which I think carries very similar horror on innocence, I would call it. I mean, Keeler is a character who is... It was pretty much press ganged into the evil role. He's owned by Chase. He can't get out of, he can't escape any of the situations that Chase puts him in. And he is the one who gets infected. And unlike the first character, he knows it and he has to actually suffer the fear of it. And that is an extremely tangible horror factor for Doctor Who. It's not, you know, like a monster. It's not like, I mean, it amazes me that Mary Whitehouse was getting upset about the monster strangling one of the scientists in the first episode, which to me, that doesn't affect kids. That affects adults strangling.
Yeah.
Drowning characters like the famous Deadly Assassin bit affects adults, not kids. Kids will get upset by seeing a guy slowly losing his body to vegetation, something which is, doesn't happen, will never happen. But for a kid, that is very potent. So I think it's one of the true horrors of Doctor Who, that story.
Yeah.
That,
in a good way.
In a good way, yeah. I mean, Resurrection of the Daleks is that bit where the guy turns around and his face is all eaten up.
Yeah.
And he knows his face is, and he's calling to his friend to help and she has to shoot him. I mean, that, again, is pretty damn horrifying for a kid. So, yeah.
There's an interesting... Those two stories that you said, Mine of Evil and Seeds of Doom, they both have that kind of sprawling epic aspect to them, don't they? And it's often been said that Seeds of Doom could have been an Avengers plot.
Yes.
But Mind of Evil isn't too far away from the Avengers either.
No, that's very true. Yeah, absolutely. No, there is some sort of similarities there. And it was interesting watching the two and not feeling too far removed from both. As I say, I think Seeds of Doom is the slightly weaker one just because the monster loses its power.
It's superbly cast, though, Seeds of Doom, isn't it?
It is very well cast. And as I say, it's just perhaps one episode too long where you could have truncated the monster bit and got away from what started to happen a lot in the later Tom Baker ones, sort of like Image of the Fendal suffers from it a bit, where you're sort of just running around a mansion a bit too much and you're losing some of the story. But yeah, both two very good Doctor Whos if you've not seen either.
Excellent. Speaking of the later Tom Baker era...
Really, yes.
Yes. I have, as regular listeners will know, been working my way through the serials that I had either never seen or had not seen completely, or had seen when they were first broadcast and not since. And as part of that, I bought the Myths and Legends box set, and I've just completed The Horns of Nymon.
Yep.
Where to start with The Horns of Nymon? First of all, I started watching it on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I started watching it on Thursday. When I was looking, and I watched it episodically, when I decided to put something on Friday evening, I'd completely forgotten that I'd watched the first episode. That does not, that's not good.
And the worst thing is, the first episode is probably one of the better ones.
Possibly, quite possibly, yeah. Now, I've seen, over the years, there's been criticisms of Graham Crowden's possibly overacting in there. To be honest with you, I think that's possibly the least of the Horns of Nymon's crimes.
Definitely.
Before I kind of go all kind of negative on it, I do want to say that I think that some of the model work in there is excellent.
Yeah.
Some of it's a little ropey, but that's mainly due to the models themselves rather than the camera work associated with the models. The explosion's really good. And a few of the long shots in space are good. It's again, that's a case of there not being enough stars in Doctor Who.
Yeah.
But then again, who's to say that every direction of the universe has got stars in it anyway?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in there.
But
it's a mess, isn't it?
Anthony
Reed, what were you doing?
I think the hammy performance, as a lot of people have said, actually saves it in some ways. It gives it a little bit of character.
Yeah.
But it's just a mess. The story is a mess. The set design is a mess. The Nymon are a mess. It drifts. You feel the boredom from the cast.
Yeah.
It just feels rubbish.
Tom Baker is clearly bored.
Yes, and you don't blame him.
No, no.
There's just nothing there for him to
There's very little direction for the guest cast.
Yeah.
Crowden's clearly taken it upon himself to do what he's done, and I don't think there's any criticism deserved to him, because I think he's done a great job with a very, very thin piece of tracing paper.
I mean, at the same time, I mean, I don't want to sort of try and, you know, rattle on, you know, the production, which, you know, was always under a lot of stress. There was always a lot of problems.
Well, they always are, though, aren't they?
I know, but, you know, but sometimes...
No, I mean, we were talking about Underworld last time, weren't we?
Yeah.
And that was clearly a production that was under a lot of stress, but that managed to pull out of it and do something rather revolutionary.
And sometimes you just won't know. Sometimes you will not be able to do it. I think it was I mean, the idea isn't so bad in itself, but it just doesn't really work for Doctor Who, maybe. Maybe that is its real crown and glory.
Some of the dialogue is really, really basic as well. The alternate Soldeed, whose name escapes me, from the other planet.
Yeah.
He, you know, I'm done for. Give me my staff and I'll hold them off.
Yeah.
George Lucas could have written that.
Yeah, no, yeah, I don't think I can fight that. It is. I mean, I think the thing that frustrates me most about it is that it is absolute trash. And yeah, even though a lot of people will sort of obviously say, yeah, it's not very good, it doesn't get half the hammering that, say, Time Lash or Time and the Rani get, which, to be fair, stories deserve a bit of a hammering, so I'm not saying that they don't. But there is something to be said about the fact that the 70s are considered with such righteous splendor when there is some real messes in there.
Yeah.
To remind you that no era is perfect, and Horns of Nymon is just one that I don't think I could ever really watch again unless I had it on in the background.
I think it's certainly going into the Time at the Rani New Earth pile.
Oh, what's about the... sound effect, as Gareth was saying last week, that sort of defines your humour?
Well, we included it in last week's podcast.
Yeah, but you hadn't actually watched that at that time.
No, I hadn't. And to be honest with you, I think it fits the scene that it's in.
Well, it fits the show.
And the tone of
this whole story that it's in, doesn't it, really, in a lot of ways. It sets you up for the sets you up for the wonder that is Horns of Nymon. It's showing exactly what was wrong with Doctor Who at the time, and it gives me no surprise whatsoever why when it came to John Nathan Turner taking over that they needed to drastically change what was happening with Doctor Who, because there were just massive problems there, massive problems.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not planning on watching it any time again. I may watch it with the commentary, and I'm watching the extras at the moment.
The commentary is quite interesting.
Yeah.
And it's quite interesting, especially from Lala Ward's point of view, because from her perspective, she really does try and stand up for the story, which is fair enough, because I think, Sarah and Bradley, they got writer on board there as well. Yeah. But I still think, even though she tries to make out that she has something good in that story, I find her part in that story doesn't serve her either. It doesn't serve anyone. It's Janet Fielding is it Janet Fielding? It is Janet Fielding, isn't it?
Janet Ellis.
Janet Ellis, yes. Fielding was Yvette Fielding, the third, the Bree Peter person after her. She's just their role there is just terrible.
The blue the Blue Peter feature on there's good.
I'm trying to remember what it was like.
Sort of covers 1963 to 1989. Doctor Who's appearances on Blue Peter. That's quite good. And you discover that, you know, Janet Ellis's voice has actually got higher as she's got older, which is very odd for anyone, really, for the voice to get higher.
Yeah, true. But Horns of Nymon, really one. Luckily, it is pretty cheap these days if you want to just sample it out of a dare.
And then you've got a free beer mat.
And you've got a free beer mat. Or you've got something to throw at anyone who supports Time of the Rani. And you won't feel any loss there. So it's a bad story. So what have you got? What's next in your list? Because you had a few, didn't you?
Yes,
you
did have a few. So we're jumping forward a few years. 10 years, 8 years. 10 years. We're jumping forward. No.
Because Curse of Fenric, was that one?
No, it's Remembrance of the Daleks.
Remembrance of the Daleks.
Then it's the Curse of Fenric.
Oh, well, I still don't think you can go wrong there.
I don't either.
It's an era that, as I've said many times before, that I think is my quintessential era, because not just because of the content, but because I was thinking about this the other night, as you do sometimes when you're lonely and sad and you're crying a lot. that era for me was my era when, you know, I was sort of like 10 or 11. So it was when I was sort of understanding Doctor Who, and I was reading the Doctor Who magazine. So it was exciting because I was waiting to see what the next season would bring. So I liked it from that point of view. Then I liked it as an extension of where it took sci-fi in the books, because I read on the books after the Doctor Who finished. And, you know, the McCoy books were very, they were doing what Doctor Who does best, challenging the concept to the point where people were absolutely disgusted. Ben Arinovich's Transit suggesting, you know, having prostitutes in it and references to semen. You know, these days you wouldn't be that surprised about that in Doctor Who, perhaps not quite so graphic, but, you know, it's a changed world. So that was fascinating. Then as an adult, I now look at it from a sort of television historical concept. And you can see in Remembrance of the Daleks and Curse of Fenric, the foreshadows of where the show would eventually go. And you can see how what Cartmell did there and McCoy was doing informed the show as much as Tom Baker did. And yet so few people really appreciate that, that I would say there's like, I would say Baker, Hartnell, Baker and McCoy, or Troughton, Baker and McCoy, I would say are probably the quintessential changing points in the show. Where Troughton took the direction of the Doctor into a way which established a new sort of version of the Doctor, which became the archetype for what came forward. Baker then took Doctor into a more youthful eccentricity that informed the Doctor from then on. And McCoy's era took the narrative and the approach to Doctor Who into what we have today. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what you think of those two.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Cast Over's podcast with a K. We will be back next week with hopefully a fuller complement of voices for you to listen to. Hopefully Brian will be feeling better next time. So until then, it's goodbye.